Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hello and welcome. It's Friday. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Remember, next week we will be off. We will be returning on weekends beginning next weekend. So you'll be able to have a week off. Then every Saturday and Sunday, you'll find brand new adventures of Beyond the Darkness with your pals, Dave and Tim. In the meantime, every Monday through Friday, make sure to check out MidnightInTheDesert.com. I'm the new host of Art Bell's former show, Midnight in the Desert. You can hear me 5 days a week. And check out all the information at MidnightInTheDesert.com for live streaming features and to subscribe and never miss a minute. All right, tonight we've got a great show. I love when we're able to explore things that many of us have watched on TV. And if you're a fan of shows like A Haunting, sometimes you want to know a little bit more about the stories. Well, our guest knew that and stepped up. She was featured on Destination America's A Haunting. And tonight she's with us this evening to talk about a very personal story. Cindy Sauer, our guest, her book, The Exorcism of Cindy Sauer. Cindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave, so much for having me on. I appreciate it. I really do.
You know, the only problem is your name is too peppy.
Yeah.
So when you say the exorcism, you want it to be the exorcism of Bette
yes.
Rose, the exorcism of Tom Daly, not the exorcism of Cindy Sauer.
Cindy
Sauer. Sounds too upbeat, right? It's too cheery. But so this is weird. Let's get to know a little bit about you, Cindy, and then we'll bring ourselves to the story. Had you had paranormal experiences through your entire life?
I absolutely have. I remember being very young, even before I knew what, you know, the term spirit or ghost meant. And my sister and I actually saw my recently deceased great-grandmother in our bedroom at night. And it terrified us, of course, but we did see her sitting in a chair. So that's the first thing that I can truly recall.
All right,
about
now do you mind if I stop you there? All right, so you saw your great grandmother.
We did.
And it terrified you. Was she holding her head in her lap? Was she screaming maniacally at you? What about it scared you?
It was terrifying. I was only five at the time, mm-hmm. and my sister was eight. We were in the bed. She woke me up. She was just shaking me and pointing, and I look up and. She's sitting, our great grandmother sitting in, it was actually her chair, and it was the foot of our bed facing us, and she was just sitting there in the gown that she was buried in, mm-hmm. Staring at us. That was it. And of course, we covered our heads. We didn't make any noise. We were terrified. We were terrified, and we just stayed under the covers until we fell asleep. And the next morning, you know, we woke up thinking, did we really, you know, was she really there? And we told our parents mm-hmm. that it was pretty scary to be such a young child and to have that kind of experience.
Well, did she seem, and I know I'm taking you back quite a few years, at least 12 or 13 years here. You said you were five. But do you, Do you remember when you saw her, did she have a look of concern? Did she seem to be like she didn't even notice you were there? It was just almost like you were looking at a living snapshot.
Oddly enough, you're right. It was almost like she did not see us, like she looked through us. And I don't know if maybe she was just sort of saying, you know, I'm here, I'm okay. But for me, it didn't feel good. It didn't feel nice. It felt really scary. And the look on her face, it was just a blank sort of stare. So it was a little bit frightening. I would like to say that I felt a sense of calm and peace, but I don't recall feeling that at all.
All right. No, and everybody reacts differently to these situations. And I know, you know, we all think, oh, well, children are more in tune and they're not afraid of these things. But if you see something that doesn't make sense in your room, you know, it'd be one thing if you didn't know great grandma was dead, or you didn't know and this was your great, great, great grandma that was sitting there. You might be like, who is that? And what is she doing in our room? But when you're consciously aware, she's not here anymore, and she's sitting in my room, I can see how that could be a very scary realization. And due to the fact that kids mature at different ages, it might have just hit you a little bit more deeply. Was there any sound or light, anything else regarding that instance that now trying to look back at it, you can recall?
There was no sound, but there was a glow. There was a sort of, it was like an aura, and it was a blue-green that she was emitting. And it was almost, she wasn't as flesh and blood as a person would be. I mean, it was, even if I hadn't known that she was not, you know, that she had passed away, it did not look normal. It didn't look like a human being sitting in a chair. It was very different, very, you know, strange and ethereal looking. So, It was very impactful. She had actually lived in the house before she passed away with us. So, you know, I was accustomed to seeing her every day. And it was her, but it didn't look like her. So that's the best description I think I can give.
Is that in the same sense that when you see somebody laying in a coffin, it looks like them, but it doesn't look like them?
Yes. Okay. That was exactly what it was like. It was just not.
It was devoid of life.
For me didn't, yeah.
Right. There was some spark missing.
Right. Okay. It was very, the dots didn't connect for me. It's like, that's her, but I just don't, like, I had a really hard time grasping that for a while.
And your sister, you started to say, how did she respond to this?
The same way. Really very much the same way. And to this day, we still speak about it. And it was kind of off-putting and scary. It really, I don't think we ever really could say that it was a comfortable and benevolent experience. You know, I have had other experiences with people who passed on being around or in dreams, and I felt secure and safe and like, you know, they were there to protect or to, you know, give me a sense of peace. But this was not really that way at all.
Interesting. Knowing what you know now and reflecting back on it, do you think it's because what you were seeing was not really a manifestation of your grandmother? It was something trying to take her shape? Or do you believe that it maybe was your grandmother in kind of a lost limbo state?
I wish I had a really good answer for that. I wish I was positive one way or the other, but I don't know. I think that's one of the things I still grapple with to this day, is that I just am not sure if that was her and what the purpose of the encounter was. There's usually some sort of significance to, you know, a loved one who has passed on and visiting us, or, you know, any other manner of, you know, a supernatural event. And that one for me just is up in the air. And I'm not sure that I'll ever have a clear answer for it at this point.
All right. That was your first conscious memory. Talking to your parents about this through life, did they ever reflect anything back to you of, well, you know, that really wasn't your first? When you were really young, you used to talk about seeing your grandfather who had been dead for 5 years. Was there ever any trigger like that?
No, not to my knowledge. We spoke about, you know, certain things. My dad really not so much as my mother. Now, my grandparents on my mom's side, we actually lived with them. And my great grandmother at the time before she passed away. So it was a really big house and we all lived together. But my, my mom and her sisters and my grandmother and grandfather all spoke of things, paranormal to an extent, on a regular basis, not really knowing what that was. You know, they didn't say, oh, this was a ghost or, you know, but there were stories to be told, by all of them about different things. I didn't put it together till I was older. And things before I was even born, about, you know, my family and the different experiences that certain family members, even ones that I hadn't met, have had, with what I now know to be, of course, paranormal, but very interesting things that you don't forget. They were Native American, actually, and I'm not sure, you know, if that has any correlation with the events, but it's been an ongoing thing throughout my family, on my mother's side, different visions and experiences and, you know, seeing apparitions, you know, having empathic sort of, abilities. So this has been something that hasn't been a secret in my family. But I'm not aware of anything at a younger age for myself.
Okay.
That occurred.
And after that incident, when was the next time that you had something you would deem to be supernatural?
Okay. This one is very interesting. My sister and I shared a room, and this was in a different room. We had actually added on to the house. And one night, her and I were getting a little too boisterous and noisy. It must have been about 2 years after my first experience. And my dad lived, you know, it was very rural out where we lived. So there were no street lights. It was our house was set pretty far back and it was surrounded by a wooded area. So when we got a little too, you know, loud at night, my dad would come in and shut off our lamp, light, whatever was in there, and shut the door to get us to be quiet. Now, I was scared of the dark already. Most kids are, many kids are, but I really was scared of the dark. So I was just happy that I had my sister there with me. We were, you know, getting quiet, trying to be quiet. And I was facing away from her. I'm facing the wall, my back turned to her. And just thinking, and we were still whispering, and she got really quiet. And I was going to ask her a question, so I turned over to ask her, and when I did, what I saw was not her. I saw what I can only describe as something like evil. It was terrible. It was this green sort of glow from this face. Her face had become long, elongated, a long chin, and just crazy hair. A turned up lip, and it was not her face at all. It was very drawn and
almost sounds
wrinkled.
Like you're describing the Wicked Witch from The Wizard of Oz.
It was worse. It was way, the face was way too long. The eyes were set way too back. It was just, it was not human looking. And it just this snarl, no noise, just this horrible, you know, kind of grimacing face. And this was a dark room. There was no light coming in from anywhere. The room was pitch black. And this is what I see. And I lose my mind. I've lost it and started to scream and yell. And I got very upset. And I closed my eyes and just put my head under the covers. She finally got me to stop and say, you know, ask what was going on. My dad came bolting in the room and, you know, turn the light on, ask him what was up. I try to tell them, and of course they are like, oh, you just had a dream, you know, go back to sleep. And he again closes the door and then shuts the light off. So I am terrified, and I tell my sister this is what I saw. She believed me, and, you know, we just sat there. We were both scared at that point, and we just laid there till we went to sleep. So that is another experience of many, but that one's one that really stands out in my mind.
Cindy, why do you think you were seeing these things? Why do you think that this energy or multiple energies were making themselves known to you?
After everything that's happened, we have, myself and a few other people who are close to me at this point, have done some looking and just some researching into different things. I want to say that it's, it could happen to anybody. We're not entirely sure what the, I've got a lot of brothers and sisters, so we're not sure why I was this target. There's talk of, past occult activity, that I may have been exposed to and have blocked or something.
Hold on. Before you just dismiss that's,
yes.
That's not just, our crazy family at Thanksgiving. You may have been exposed to cult activity that you forgot. Can you reel that back for me? Where does the theory begin, and with whom were you exposed?
There was a family member, and I won't go into great detail about, people. But there was a family member who stayed with us for a time. And that person was a very odd person and continued to be an odd person throughout. Now, he was connected, like I say, with family. So it's not like you lose touch or get rid of family. But this person had some belongings that they had hidden in a box in a shed that we had that my sister and I found. And it was... we didn't know at the time what it was. We found pentagrams on the floor that were drawn out in black. And we found a bag with a cloak in it and some books of strange, just books. And we at the time didn't know what it was. And see, a lot of this, like I said, I've put together as an adult and thought, it comes back to, and you're like, it's not something you ever forget. But then when you start to tie things together, it's like, okay, this is odd. This is crazy. And the people that I spoke to, and trying to tell every detail that I can remember, they're incredible people and people who would know what, occult activity is like. And, there's some talk that maybe I was affected by this. And I have vague memories of this person that, me being alone with them. And this would be at a very small age, at like 2 or 3, that I do have these vague memories, but I don't know if that's, anything to do with it. I don't know, but it's a possibility, because when this kind of stuff happens and you seem to be a target, you go through every scenario and you want to be able to try to explain things and not leave anything out. You've got to explore every avenue if you want to get answers. And the biggest part of the past, 8 years of my life have been looking for answers, and you can't dismiss anything. You've got to really dig into these things. So that is a theory. I'm not sure how we get to the bottom of it, but that is one of the things that we have kind of looked into. About everything, and whether that could be part of an issue. The priest that I spoke to, the priest that helped me through this, mentioned, some stuff about maybe there being abuse that I did not remember and things of that nature that he felt may be a significant part of it that might need to be addressed. So, following all of that, we just sort of, it's something we have to look at. These things don't just pop up, books and cloaks and pentagrams on floors. And this was not recent. We're not talking like 10 years ago. This was like 40 years ago. So, this wasn't something that was discussed back then. It wasn't something that you readily knew. There was no internet. You couldn't look these things up. This is something that, you put it together now, but back then there was no way for us to say, especially being so young, say, this is what this is. But we knew when we found these things that they belonged to this kind of scary, creepy guy. And we also knew that they weren't good. And we dropped them and put them back and left them. We're like, no, you know, we're not coming back in here. So there is some significance to it, whether it be a dead end or not, and whether we find anything else out or are able to, you know, see what really happened or see the end result is sort of up in the air at this point. But it is something that we have to look at and discuss.
So did this activity begin to ramp itself up throughout your life to this crescendo point, or would it ebb and flow to be there for a while and then disappear? How did that work?
It would come and go. It would come and go. It did sort of intensify later on in life, but it did come and go where, you know, you forget about it. And we're people, things kind of fade out and we're like, okay, good. You know, normal life is good. You want to have normal life and that's what you hold on to. But then this ever present thing just rears its ugly head. And at first, you know, it took me a long time to figure out that, hey, maybe this isn't the best. You know, maybe this isn't so great. I mean, I got into, before ghost hunters and all that, I got into sort of doing a little bit of research in different places because I was so fascinated by it. Even at a young age, you know, after everything that happened, I really didn't say, okay, well, it's the paranormal. Back then it wasn't the paranormal. It was a ghost and spirits. You know, you go to the library and there's that one little weird section where they have all the cryptid books and the ghost books. And I was there every week. You know, I was that kid. They're like, oh, she's over there again. And I would just sit in and just mull over these books in this section and was completely wrapped with this idea. Not knowing how to grasp, but not knowing, you know, really, is it something I'm afraid of, or is it something that just I'm so fascinated with that it's kind of become a part of me. And so I researched, and even as a child, I was looking this stuff up, and I knew all the old ghost stories about the lady on the stairs, you know, the gray lady and all those things. And they were just completely fascinated me.
Doesn't that then put you in the set of mind that you also have to be very cautious, because sometimes we are so into something and so intrigued and interested by it that maybe we make leaps of faith that aren't always logical.
Absolutely.
I
do believe that.
Okay. And have you caught yourself doing that too, where you're like, oh my God, no, it was just the cat. Or, you know, you realize that it was nothing malevolent, dark, or evil, but that initial reaction was kind of the PTSD of the paranormal.
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody would do that. Now, at a young age, it was so romanticized, you know, as far as these books go, they didn't talk about the bad things, you know, and demons. And I went to church. I grew up Methodist. So we were not, you know, taught about the demons. The devil was under the ground and he was this bad guy and you didn't listen to him and God loved you. And you know, that was that. You just loved God and listened to, you know, his words. And that's how we grew up. I wasn't exposed to, oh, there's this evil, you know. Even as I watched the movie when I was 13, The Exorcist, okay? And I was absolutely mortified. This movie shook me to my core. It was the scariest thing I'd ever seen. And since, it still is to me. And I was just like, that is so horrifying. I never knew, okay, this is loosely based on a true story about a boy. But I was like, oh, I'm glad this isn't real. You know, even though it took me like 2 weeks to want to be by myself after I watched it. I still was under the impression that this stuff was just fairy tale and that, you know, demons were sort of a metaphor. It was never spoken about. Even when I got older and I started to delve into, like, you know, maybe going to graveyards and listening to things and, you know, taking my new digital camera, because that's when they were, you know, those big boxy things that you had to plug into your computer. It was fascinating. I really didn't believe, even if it was just to block it and I didn't want to think about it, I really did not want to believe that demons were something that I would ever encounter. I avoided anything to do with it while looking up things, all things, you know, ghost or paranormal on the internet when I first got it. I did not go near the demon stuff. And the experiences I had back then, it was sort of a lull at that point. We had little things happen around our house, which was a newer house when I was married, but they were significant enough to know that, whoa, okay, that was really weird. Again, I didn't say, okay, we have a ghost. But now looking back at those certain things that happen, you know, I can better put them together. I really never thought, okay, ghosts are here, ghosts follow me, whatever. You know, I didn't jump to that. That was not something that I was totally just went to because it scared me, honestly. You know, I was still afraid of even though I was fascinated, I really didn't want to see a ghost or, you know, a spirit or whatever else there is. I didn't really want to see it. There's just that part of me that was just really scared still. After everything that had happened, I think part of me was still on the fence even. And that maybe ghosts aren't real. Maybe, you know, maybe it is all just this big romantic fairy tale, and that it's just, you know, I wanted it to still be that. I wanted it to still be something that was just, you know, really, really a place I could go and just kind of an escape, and had this mystique to it still. And unfortunately, I lost that completely. It came to a screeching halt. It was actually a few years before my husband died that things took a turn for the odd. Honestly, they got a little bit negative, and I still was in denial. But yeah, I mean, I think anybody would, you know, anybody that's into it, some people want so much to see something, and they want so much to experience it that they're going to call everything a ghost. Just like these days, everybody calls anything a demon. Anything that happens, it's demonic. Which I kind of have an issue with that, you know, to a certain extent, because they don't understand what it is like to actually deal with these things. And if they did, they wouldn't call everything demonic because they don't want to have to deal with it. And it makes it very difficult for people who do have to endure this stuff when everything is labeled a demon, because it's sort of a crying wolf situation where it's heard so much that people become numb to it and stop really, you know, believing that this could be real. It's all a big TV thing and a popularity contest and for publicity. And the reality of it is it's not. It's very real. And I'm hoping that I can maybe make people more aware of the fact that it is real. It's not fun and it's not exciting. It's not something that you want to dig into. I know I didn't. I know I didn't ask for it. I wasn't searching for it. I definitely was not looking for it. This was something that was the worst thing possible to me. It was a nightmare. Like, I could not fathom the idea of having to deal with it. And I did. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I really wouldn't.
The sister that had the experiences with you, did she also find herself kind of plagued with this, or did this just become a solo journey? Like the phenomena was surrounding you, not so much your sister.
She's had many things happen, but she has also been, she approaches things a little bit differently. She doesn't mind, you know, kind of delving into Ouija boards and things like that, but I completely stay away from that. She has not been plagued as far as demonic activity. She sees things, I think, and hears things because she sort of looks for things at times, but it's completely different for her than it is for me. it was a totally different ride. So there was this separation that happened with that. And there still is. In fact, I really, there's a separation with my family altogether with this situation. There are a few of them that still, you know, I still have a relationship with, but there are several people who I don't have a relationship with anymore, because of the death of my husband and, you know, what followed with, the demonic, activity. And so it really did take a toll on a lot of my relationships and a lot of my life. So there is a separation that happened, and there was no one that I could really go to and say, this is what's going on, you know, and they walked with me through it as far as my family goes. It was very isolating, which is one of the major tools that these things use against the victim. I don't know if I really would say victim. I suppose people would, but I guess a host would be a better word. They are very proficient at that. And isolation is one of the first and best ways that they have to start to control what's going on around you. You know, we all have these classic labels of you know, demonic activity, and it's infestation and oppression and possession. You know, it's not that cut and dry. It doesn't happen. It's not on a level where you can say, okay, this is what's going on next. This will happen. And then this will happen. And things jump back and forth. It's chaotic. It's not that cut and dry. It's just not, it creates absolute chaos in everything, in your relationships, in your daily life, in your head, with your emotions, with your psyche, with every part of you. It's just absolute chaos. So
do you think, though, because you had such a fascination with the paranormal and kind of did immerse yourself, do you think that was kind of a psychic invitation for what was taking place in your life?
No, I really don't think so. I don't think I was, because I experienced things at such a young age, and because there was never this draw to, like, communicate. That's the thing. I never felt like I want to communicate with, you know, people who have passed on, or spirits, documenting, you know, like if you take a picture and see something, things like that, fascinated me, and looking at these pictures online, but I never felt the need to say, hey, I want to talk to a dead person. That was just too much for me. I think that there are certain levels of, you know, communication or of interest that will get you in trouble. I really do think that. I think people put themselves at risk a lot and don't realize it. Does that mean that I think everybody's going to get possessed by a demon? No, I don't think that at all. I think that there has to be, you know, it's more than it's almost like a perfect storm, you know, and we don't know what, you know, what the recipe calls for. We just don't know what those things are and how they line up and what makes one person a target and not another. I struggle with that very much because, you know, like I said, my family is a big family. Why? What does this have to do with me? You know, what is the reason? That to me really plagued me for a long time, because you want to put the puzzle together. How can you do that? You know, I don't know how.
Now, Cindy, I understand this kind of questioning. Why me? Why is this happening in my whole family? Why is this? Have you ever considered going in for hypnosis, A, to maybe kind of regress you back to a younger age to find out what had happened to you so that we can see if we can disconnect from that? And secondly, is this karmic weight that you're bringing forward from past lives?
I actually have considered that. I have, you know, I've spoken to some people about it. Up to this point, and not really this point, up to like a recent time, I was really terrified to do that because I was so weak still, and still had things happening that I was terrified that if I did, you know, go under hypnosis, that I didn't know what would happen. Just the idea of sort of letting go and opening myself up like that, just it was a really scary thought. I'm a lot better now. I'm a lot stronger. And it's something that I'm interested in doing. I think that it can't hurt to try, and it may yield some pretty interesting answers. So that is something I'm actually considering doing. I'm not sure when. I can't, you know, give a timeline on that, because at this point, things are really kind of rolling, and I'm pretty busy, but it is something that I definitely want to visit in the future and consider doing.
We might have to connect you with Peter James Haviland, who's been a guest on our show, but is proficient in this type of thing. So maybe we can connect you two off air and then have a follow-up show to talk about that. Let's do this. We've got to take a break. Before we do, though, folks, it's time for your favorite part of Fridays and mine. As we dig into the archives, we go deeply into Theater of the Mind. Tonight's Theater of the Mind comes to us from a special source, Dr. Andrew Nichols. Dr. Nichols is the director of the American Institute of Parapsychology and has been a professor of psychology for many years. He holds a doctorate degree in clinical psychology, and is the author and co-author or editor of more than 50 research papers, popular articles and books on paranormal topics, including Ghost Detective, Adventures of a Parapsychologist, Haunted Houses, and Ghosts, Spirits, and Hauntings. Andrew has investigated more than 600 cases of reported haunted houses and poltergeists. Tonight's story is related from his direct experience in this Theater of the Mind, The Sleep of the Damned. As a parapsychologist, I'm often asked if I've ever been really frightened during an investigation. I've certainly spent many nights in dark cellars, dusty attics, and deserted European castles, but I can honestly say that I have rarely experienced anything which I found particularly scary. I've personally witnessed apparitions and poltergeist activity on several occasions, and although these experiences were startling and fascinating, I never regarded them as personally threatening. Most haunting investigations are rather tedious and involve hours and hours of waiting for something, anything to happen. However, some years ago, I suffered a particularly terrifying sleep-related experience following my investigation of a poltergeist disturbance. The case involved the phenomena typically associated with such events: unexplained movement of objects, percussive sounds emanating from the walls and ceiling of the home, and, somewhat unusual, sightings of amorphous, shadowy apparitions. The epicenter of the phenomena appeared to be an 11-year-old girl with emotional problems. The family believed their home was haunted by a demon. In view of subsequent events, I'm forced to admit that the family's simple religious explanation may be closer to the truth than my scientific one. I have investigated a number of such cases during my 4 decades of psychic research and, like most academically oriented parapsychologists, had always tended to attribute such disturbances to unconscious projection of paranormal energies from a human agent, described in parapsychological jargon as recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. My experience with the case led me to seriously reconsider the spirit hypothesis as a possible explanation for some haunting and poltergeist cases, and to reevaluate certain cases of alleged demonic possession as well. I had gone to bed along with my wife after a day of investigation at the home of the poltergeist-infested family. Sometime in the early morning, I awakened to find myself in the midst of an out-of-body experience. I found myself floating face down about 4 feet above my physical body. I could clearly see the details of my sleeping body below, lying on my back, and my wife sleeping on her side facing away from me. I had a couple of OBEs previously, but none as vivid as this one. I was delighted, and I wanted to maintain this wonderful sensation as long as possible. As I hovered there in midair, I was contemplating an attempt at astral travel to discover if I could project my etheric body to some distant location. At that moment, The experience turned into a terrifying struggle for my sanity and, corny as it sounds, my soul. Unexpectedly, the eyes of my sleeping body below me opened. The eyes, my eyes, were completely black. No pupils, no iris, just a jet black sclera. Pools of darkness staring up at me. I knew instantly that those eyes could see me. Although, I was also certain that my floating astral body would have been invisible to anyone else standing nearby. I knew with absolute certainty that something had taken possession of my body, and that the thing, whatever it was, could see me perfectly well. My body below grinned at me. It seemed to be enjoying my terror, and I was instantly aware of two things. First, I knew I had to get back into my body very quickly, or I would be forever displaced by this entity, which, I had absolutely no doubt, was evil. Somehow, was it maybe telepathy? I also knew that this thing intended to harm my wife. I began to struggle to re-enter my body, and the feeling was like pushing against an invisible barrier, similar to the feeling one gets when trying to force two magnets of opposing polarity together. This struggle to reincorporate myself was the last thing I remembered until I suddenly found myself back in my physical body. Except I was no longer lying supine in bed, but was crouching over my wife with my hands around her throat as she fought to break my grip, screaming at me to wake up. After we both regained some degree of composure, I explained to her what I had been experiencing, and she described her version of the story. She was awakened by the sounds of me groaning and muttering what sounded like a foreign language which she did not recognize. She assumed I was having a nightmare, and when she tried to awaken me, I attacked her, my eyes wide open and apparently growling at her like a rabid dog. She said that the voice which emanated from my body was deep and gravelly, totally unlike my own, and the expression on my face she described as leering and hateful. My attack only lasted for a few seconds before I came to myself again. Now, my wife is no shrinking violet. She has, for many years, suffered a husband who spends time chasing spooks, but this was really too much. She informed me sternly that if my episode had lasted just a few more moments, she would have treated me to a broken nose. To this day, I'm amazed that I didn't land in jail, find myself hauled into divorce court, or at least spend the rest of my married life sleeping on the couch. However, my long-suffering spouse seemed to take the experience in stride, although I assure you, she slept with one eye open for some time afterwards. Thank God there's been no reoccurrence of this condition of possession. So, was I actually possessed by some dark spirit? I'm a long way from being convinced, although I confess, I can't dismiss the possibility either. I can't state with scientific certainty that this experience was anything other than a particularly vivid and horrific nightmare. I have no witnesses other than my wife and no evidence that this was anything other than subjective. Certainly, my psychologist colleagues would dismiss the incident as a dream, a variation of the night terror syndrome, possibly induced by anxiety associated with my involvement in the poltergeist case. Psychoanalysts would probably also speculate that repressed hostility toward my wife was at the root of this experience. I cannot offer any evidence to contradict these explanations, but the experience was so terrifying, so real, that I can't help wondering if the spiritualist's interpretation of possession is closer to the truth.
Beyond the darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. How'd you like to get off your ass and come on out and meet me? Well, it's real easy. I'll be in Salt Lake City coming up soon here in the beginning of June. Tim and I will be in Tombstone, Arizona for the 25th anniversary of the movie Tombstone. Frank Stallone will be on site. So will Michael Biehn and some other great actors. Hopefully we're going to get him on the show. We will be there recording and bringing you editions of Beyond the Darkness from Tombstone. So make sure you keep checking that out. I'll be at other events throughout the year, but we have about 6 spots left open for our Romania trip. If you are interested in joining me as we go in search of Dracula, ghosts, the Strigoi, UFOs, and more, sign up. So UFOs, you say, Dave? Yes, we're going to start at the Baisu Forest, which is kind of this nexus of paranormal activity. It is one of the most haunted forests in the world. They've also seen UFOs, strange cryptids and beasts. We get to investigate that forest. We're also going to see 4 of the different castles associated with Vlad the Impaler and investigate 2 of them. We've got a lot of stuff planned. It's going to be amazing. This will be my 3rd and final trip to Romania until I'm ready to retire and move there. I love Romania. If I could live anywhere in the world, Romania would be the place. But I'd have to have my kids with me. I love my kids. I'd miss my kids. But Romania is amazing. The history, the legends, the lore, the beauty of the countryside. If you're interested in joining us, go check out darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. And join me on the road to the strange and supernatural. We will share high strangeness. There's no doubt about it. All that information is on our site at darknessevents.com. And if you're interested in getting the book, The Exorcism of Cindy Sauer, well, you can send me $256 and I'll get you a copy. Or you can just go directly to darknessradio.com and click on the Killer Deals link. It'll take you to the Amazon store and you'll find the book there along with other great books for normal price. So if you really love Darkness Dave, $250, I'll get you a copy of the book and I will possess myself with her soul to autograph it for you. Or you can just get a copy for $20 off of Amazon. Either way you want to do it. I'm just saying I'm willing to work with you here. Cindy Sauer, our guest, The Exorcism of Cindy Sauer. All right. Now start to, in this segment, let's ramp this sucker up. How did this possession begin for you?
Ah, okay. Well,
you knew we'd get there eventually, Cindy.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I did. That's what it is about. It was actually after my husband passed away. We had been together since I was a kid. Well, not a kid, but, you know, a teenager, 17, I met him. We were together for many years. He was a great person. He just had, a lot of things he dealt with. He dealt with alcoholism for a good while, for a lot of his life. He was sober at the time, but he had a lot of issues with depression. And he did commit suicide in 2009. So the kids and I did not live at the house for a good while, you know, for a couple of months. And it was paid for. It was my house. I had to do something with it. And it only made sense, you know, for us to be there. It was very difficult. I didn't have, you know, life insurance to fall back on or anything. I was sort of thrust into this single mom life. You know, no dad, no, you know, there to help. No, you know, even if you divorce, you still have the other parent. We didn't have that. And a lot of my family sort of, you know, it was too much for them to deal with. So
can I ask you real quickly, Cindy, because yes. I know that the listeners are probably champing at the bit about this. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your husband took his life in 2009. Was there precursors to this? Was this something that we knew about, that there was, you know, mental issues? And I don't mean that in a negative light, but I just mean, you know, depression, anxiety, or was this kind of out of the blue?
It really wasn't out of the blue. It was not. There were several attempts made throughout his life. And there was actually one the week before he actually did take his own life. There was an incident where he had tried and failed. So this was not something new. And he was at the doctor and taking antidepressants and some other medication. I felt like he needed to be, you know, inpatient, but that wasn't my call. So
now, had his life been affected at all? You know, I mean, mental illness is what mental illness is. Many of us, including myself, deal with depression and anxiety. And, yes. You know, it's a constant war that we wage to keep those wolves at bay. And I don't like to discount real science with pseudoscience of the supernatural, but were there things in his life that would lead you to believe that maybe there was a dark energy or force at work in his life?
Yes, there were things. Some of them I won't get into just because, you know, his family, that's
out of
his
respect.
Family.
I understand, right?
Yes. But there are things that I experienced myself that were pretty disconcerting. There were times when he was violent, just out of the blue, which was, you know, it was not a violence like, okay, I'm just pissed off. This was just this absolute rage that would come over him. It was not like him at all. And I didn't put anything together, you know, at the moments when it was happening. It was just like, okay, he's drunk or, you know, he's just really mad. It didn't happen often, but it did happen. There was an incident one time where he was fine. And we were, some friends of ours and I were sitting at a table. We were all playing cards. And he was fine. And then out of the blue, he stands up at the table and slams his hands down on the table, and just his face just started to sort of change a little bit. I wasn't the only one that we all saw it. His face sort of, it turned, his eyebrows kind of turned up, his eyes went to slits, his nose sort of flared out, and his lip turned up, and he did this really weird smile. And then he just walked off, and we all stood there or sat there looking at each other, just scratching our heads. It was really strange. It happened again. You know, we had separated toward the end. The things were just really, really difficult. His depression, very, very. And I made the decision to, you know, for the kids and I to move out. And during that time, the kids actually witnessed something similar to that when they were at a restaurant with him, when they were visiting. So there were things like that that, you know, just weren't him before he died. Very, very close to the time when he did, I would come around him and he already looked like he was dead. And it was very difficult to look at. He smelled like he was dead. And I did not understand this. I didn't understand. Yeah. When I left, I would come, you know, we weren't very far up the road, so I would come and visit him. I would bring the kids over. I would, you know, sit and talk with him and make him food and clean things up. And he just became very debilitated.
And was there any kind of, workup done to look at the possibility of brain tumors? This sounds like it could be brain tumor activity as well.
They did do an autopsy, and there was nothing that showed anything out of the ordinary.
All right.
So medically, he was okay. But it was not just him, though. It was the house as well. The house took on a really it was almost like there was a film of negativity around the house. It didn't feel like my home, the home that I had made for, you know, 12 years. It didn't feel that way. It took on a different presence right before he died. It was really strange. The kids didn't want to go over. I didn't want to go over. And I sort of, you know, weaned off of going over there as often. But, you know, then one day I was at the grocery store. I'd pick the kids up from school. It was only a mile from my house. And my friend called me and told me to get over to the house immediately. And I knew something was really wrong, but I just didn't know what. And so I went over as fast as I could to the house and parked across the street, and the yard was full of police officers, and, you know, the coroner's van was there. it's just a lot of people in my yard that weren't supposed to be there. And I didn't understand what was going on. And his mother came out of my house and she was screaming. And you know what's happened, but you don't, you can't, your brain can't connect that. And, you know, I had two men walk up to me and tell me, you know, they asked me some questions. I don't, to this day, I don't remember really what they were. And I just said, please tell me. And they said that they found the subject deceased. And I knew, you know, that he was gone. Mm. And so, you know, it was sort of from there. It was a blur. And then, you know, a few months later, as I said, we moved back in. And that was one of the hardest decisions at that point I would have had to make for my kids. And, you know, I knew it was the best thing, but financially, but it was really hard. And going back in and having to, you know, to make this a house again for my kids and a home for them was a daunting task. And you could feel that it was not right, but I was determined to make it right when we came back. And so that's what I set about doing when we first got back, is to make it in our house again and to cleaning up anything that I needed to clean up, and you know, repainting and tearing out floors, things like that, and just set to work and really focused on that. And it went really well, for, you know, as well as it could go with grieving kids. And it went pretty well for about a year, a little less than a year. And then things started to happen that weren't right.
And how did that begin?
Well, one day I was bending down to take my youngest out of her seat and unbuckling her, and something grabbed me from behind and it grabbed me hard. And I, you know, I hop up to look and there's nothing there. So at that point I'm like, okay, well, that's weird, you know? And I just kind of went on with things. My niece was watching my youngest while I went and picked the others up from school up the street. And I come back and she's in the yard with, you know, my youngest in her arms, and she's completely lost all color in her face. And she explained to me how the Bible had flown off the table and across the room, and pages had torn out the entire way. And it absolutely had. I went inside and it was a mess with these papers across the floor. And the Bible was probably about 9 or 10 feet away from where it had started. The crucifix that was on the wall fell off. And it was one that we had bought at a yard sale a few years ago. Like, you know, it was nothing, you know, I'm not Catholic. So it was just sort of, you know, okay, well, it's protection. It's nice. We'll put it over here. And it broke off right under the wrists on both sides, very evenly. And it was metal, so that's really interesting. Things like that started to happen. And I, you know, we were like, okay, well, Jim, you know, my husband, we were like, we know you're here. And it's okay. We're going to be okay. But, you know, the way that he went out to me was of great concern. Because we're taught, you know, that if you take your own life, that it's bad.
Right.
He was upset and angry and depressed. So the state that he was in, really, it was very concerning. And you know, I still loved him very much, but it was, I was worried. I was worried that maybe, because we don't know, you know, when you leave this plane, we don't know if those negative feelings carry with you or what happens. Right. Really, we don't. And that was a concern. I was afraid that he was really mad at me. there was an incident where my daughter saw him standing outside, leaning against a tree, and it terrified her. It absolutely, and she was daddy's girl. You know, this child loved her daddy, mm-hmm. and she was she was just shaking. She was so scared. It took her a while to just calm down and to come back to herself. And she explained to me, she saw him there, but it wasn't, she said that just wasn't him. And so I'm thinking, we're dealing with someone who's upset and pissed off, and rightly so. But, you know, what do you do with that at the same time? I'm here with my kids. I can't leave, and I don't want him to be upset and angry, but what do you do? So at that point, I really thought that this is what we were dealing with. And I really had no clue what to do. I wasn't going to the same church anymore. You know, ties with these people were sort of strained because of everything that had happened. So I just sort of relied on my friends. And I can't say that at that point I was, you know, my faith was very strong in anything.
Right.
And I didn't pray at the time. I just was very... I was upset. I didn't know how to take things. So, you know, it's one thing to have to deal with the fact that, you know, I've got to help my kids get through this and got to find a way to make money. And another thing to think, okay, my dead husband's really angry and he's still here. So yeah, it was a pretty volatile time, around then. And, I still was not thinking, you know, demonic or evil. At that, I still wasn't. There's a point where
it makes sense, right? Well, you're trying to rationalize. You're dealing with a loss. You're dealing with your children. You're seeing this logically. You can make the sense. Oh, my husband's soul is at unrest. It's that. So I understand that. I think most of our listeners do as well. That's a normal part of it. And you being intelligent and not jumping to conclusions, you didn't automatically start to assume it's the demonic realm. What starts to amp it up that starts to realize that, oh, there's something more going on? And I also need to know, how old were your children at this age?
I had four at that time. I had a young one. And see, most people don't know this because I really chose to keep the younger children out mm-hmm. of, you know, things with the show. So I had a young one. I had one who was eight at that time, then a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old who had recently, before things started to ramp up, she had actually moved out of the house. She really had a hard time moving back in. So, she did end up leaving, when she was 17. So, you know, they varied in age, they were spread out, but, it was still a job.
Right.
It was definitely a job because they did, you know, they did step up in age. So it wasn't like I was dealing with a set of teenagers or, you know, like it was different for each child, the way that I approached them, not only their, you know, their mental status and how they had dealt with things, but also, on their age level,
right.
You know, how you deal with it, because you can't hide it from the 13-year-old, almost 14. You can't hide it from her because she's experiencing these things. The other two, it was easier because they're a little bit oblivious to things. And I was very, very careful. And, you know, as far as what we spoke of and how I reacted to things that did happen, you know, it wasn't like we jumped up and like, oh my gosh, you know, when things would happen, it was sort of a, you know, I look at Chas, she looks at me like, okay, we know this, you know, you saw that, I saw that. Okay. And you kind of log it in your memory and move on and try to keep things, you know, light and not negative. And so that's an extra effort that you have to put in. Even before we're talking about anything affecting me personally, you know, this is just occurrences that are happening around. These are exterior, you know, exterior issues. And, that in itself was hard enough. So, you know, that was one thing. And then we get into a deeper level, and this is when things really took a turn, that, you know, like I said, external experiences happened, before then, but there was a night, you know, I had met Jason and, we started dating about, April of 2011. And, he would come over, you know, on a pretty regular basis and, you know, hang out with me and the kids for the weekend or sometimes during the week. And, I was still, you know, fascinated with paranormal things. And there was a house that I had seen before and sort of lost track of where it was. It was, when I had gone to pick up a friend of one of my daughters. And I'd seen this house at the end of the street, and it was amazing. It was just the, you know, the mansion in this little town called Covington. And I had no idea it was there, even though I'd lived there, you know, most of my life. But it was just unbelievable. And I never could find it again. Well, this one day I was, you know, searching for houses to rent because we come to the point to where we decided maybe it was time to move on from the house and maybe things would calm down. So I'm looking for rental signs. I drive to the end of the street and across from the stop sign down this driveway is this house. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay. I found it. This is, you know, I was amazed. So I drove up, to the house and there was a little roundabout right in front of the house. And I stopped and took some pictures and I was just like enthralled. It was the most amazing thing you've ever seen. And it looked just like something out of a movie. So I was pretty excited and I sent the pictures to Jason. I'm like, look at this. This is so cool. And, he, you know, we discussed going in and, you know, seeing if there was, you know, a ghost or spirit or something, okay. You know, just kind of playing around and not taking it seriously, but it was cool to explore. We're like, how are we going to do this? So we went during the day and we looked around, we got in the house, you know, just got a feel for it and, the layout. It was huge. The house was massive, a big, huge cellar, basement thing that was just, it was huge. And in fact, during the day when we were there, he opened the door or I opened the door to, I didn't know what it was. It was under the stairs and there are these steps going down and there was a person or a figure that was black, darker than the rest of the black at the bottom. And he kind of shot over to the left. And I was like, you know, we had it on video one time and I was like, oh, there's somebody down there. Hmm. And, so we went and looked and there's nobody down there. So we went through the house, you know, not really, you know, taking it too seriously. We went all the way up to the attic and this, like I said, the house is massive. I couldn't really go into the attic. I didn't feel comfortable. It felt really bad and off, so I chose not to go up there. But long story short, we went out and we decided we were going to come back that night. So we waited, you know, until it was really, really late. And Jason and I came ourselves back to the house. We never made it into the house that night. I felt really, really bad before we got there. Something in me was just saying, just don't do it. And I there was a knot in my stomach and it was like, don't do it. But me being the person that I am, I'm going to do it anyway, you know? So we did go and we made our way around toward the back of the house where we had gotten in before. We thought we heard a car go back to where we parked under this little street light. And to the left of the house and things were just wrong. And that's the best way I can put it is I just felt like everything was not right. There was something just darting between bushes and trees and brush all around. It was, everything started to sort of like move and just there was, it's like everything was moving. I can't really explain. It's almost like you're in this vortex of something and it's just all around. And I really got agitated. I got upset. I didn't like it. It started to escalate really quickly. And I was just at the point of panic and there was no reason for it, but it felt like there was just wind and just movement. And so I told him, I said, we've got to get out of here. I'm cold. I don't like this. Let's get in the car. I go around to my side to open the door and it's locked. And I'm just like, unlock the door. Like, please, you know, open the door. And I felt like something was just, it was coming after me. And I turned to look behind me at this grove of trees. It's probably about 15 yards away from me. And there is something coming through these trees. It's like a vapor, like energy. I don't know. I can't. It was like a, you know, when you're on a hot street, it's
right,
a hot
that,
day.
That you wavy could, like, lines the, you see from the road.
Wavy vapor. That's what this thing looked like. And this was September, the end of September in Georgia. And it's not cold, but it's definitely not hot. And it was at night. Whatever this thing was coming through these trees, and it didn't just come through the trees. It moved these trees. It took this one tall pecan tree, and it came through it in like it was going to rip it down.
Jeez, and this almost sounds like, have you ever seen the Evil Dead movies?
I have.
It sounds like that thing that's rushing through the woods. That's kind of insane. Yeah.
I've never thought of and I'm not talking like this 8 to 10. This thing was big. It was like, it was massively huge, like 25, 30 feet big, huge thing. And it didn't have any sharp defined lines. It was this big thing. And it came through those trees. I just turned to pull the door open and get in. And this thing hits me before anything else could happen. I get in the car and get the door shut. But it's behind me, and it's like right there, just screaming, just this horrible. It's there, and we're going down the driveway, but and I'm just sinking down in the seat and covering my ears. I don't know what to do, and that was the first really incident that it went on from there. It the whole entire incident lasted a while. I'm not sure how long, but it got really bad. In that moment, that, you know, we didn't get home that morning till sunrise, and it wasn't that far from the house. We were only about 10 or 15 minutes from my house, but we had to keep stopping, and really it got bad, and it got so bad that at that point I knew that I had just dealt with a demon. There was no denying it. And I was drained. I was tired. I was upset. I was scared. I was still, it was surreal. I didn't believe it, but there was a demon that had gotten into me, and I felt it. And it was like it ripped part of me away when it happened. And so that was the first time when I really knew that it was something not good. And I didn't really even equate it to things at the house yet. I just thought we had a bad experience in a bad place. And I left it at that. But that was not the case. And a few weeks later, you know, we had things happen. And I realized that it was not just that house, that it was there. So it took probably about another month of things occurring. And they occurred a lot around me and inside me that I knew that I had to do something, and I had to get help because there was something inside me. And, that's when I looked up the, paranormal team that helped me. And I just called them and said, I need help. And they asked me why. And I said, I think I'm dealing with a demon. So they agreed to come out pretty quickly. They did. And I'm not sure what they were expecting. Because I'm sure they get calls. I know that you get calls a lot of people. Oh, there's a demon in my house.
Right.
But I don't think they were prepared for, what happened. And, it was pretty clear to them from, you know, their first visit. And it was their only visit as far as just investigating. That they were dealing with something bad. And it was only 2 weeks about when they first came out that Father Darren, or He is, you know, he's an Orthodox priest.
Mm-hmm.
He came out to meet me. That's what they said. He wanted to come out and speak to me, but it knew what that meant, and I knew what that meant, and he knew what that meant as well. And everybody who was involved, there were a lot of things that weren't told to me at first, because you can't tell a person who is possessed or oppressed, whatever people, you know, want to refer this to or as, you can't tell them things, because it's as good as telling your enemy, you know, what your plan of attack is. And so, I was kept in the dark about a lot. There were things that I knew that I wasn't supposed to know, though, because I was told these things.
By who?
By the demon.
Okay. Now, was this demon in you at this point, or was it around you?
And it was both.
Okay. And how did it get entry to you? I mean, from my understanding, you have to give free will to allow a demon in.
But that's a funny and tricky thing. And that's very interesting. That's something that I really, really need to hit on, because these things have a way of forcing your hand. It's not like you say, oh, come in, I don't even like saying things like that, so I won't. But there are ways and tactics that they have of making you relent. And it doesn't have to be an open invitation. It just has to be you relenting and saying, please stop this. If you do this, and then you just even think the wrong thing. I have been in between a dream, in between a dream and wake state, and had one tell me to invite it in. And me being on the edge of inviting this thing in and come to and realize what's going on quick enough to say, no, this, I'm not going to do this, but knowing exactly what it is. They are very, very sneaky about this. They are very tactical about it. All they right, are so not you, these.
Now, do you believe that you're dealing with one or multiple entities, demons?
I'm not sure that you ever deal with just one. Honestly, I don't think that you ever deal with one. I think once in my experience, and I can only speak on what I've been through, in my experience, when one of them knows you, then they all know you. And if you deal with one, you deal with more. It's always a package deal in my experience. But like I said, that's what I've gone through. In the research I've done, there aren't many cases that I can find. Of course, you can't find many anyway.
Right.
Just because it's the nature of the subject. I have not found where someone says, okay, I've had an exorcism or deliverance and everything's okay. I don't find that to be the case.
So the investigators come in, they start trying to figure out what's going on with you. You've got an oppression and a possession that's taking place. Are you becoming a threat to your family or your children at any point?
No.
Okay.
No.
What are the demons doing and saying to you? Are they trying to get you to hurt yourself? Are they just mucking with you and keeping you from sleeping, like they're trying to break you down? Walk us through that situation.
Well, they were very much breaking me down at first, and they did. They were around by my bed, in the walls, whispering, saying things, so that I did not sleep. That was hampered. They would come into me in different ways, which was always uncomfortable and really, really horrible. Sometimes through my spine into my head, sometimes through my stomach. It was either the lower back or down in my, like reproductive area, I'm speaking like my stomach, lower stomach area. And it was slightly painful. I knew it was happening. And there were times when even other people could look at my stomach and see just the the pushing and the moving. You know, it was really, it was obvious. It was very blatant as far as what it would happen. It was never something slight at that point. You know, everything up to that point had been sort of, well, what was that? Was that, you know, is it something I can just chalk up to something else? But these were things I couldn't, and it was happening to me and inside me and right outside of me, in my head, that, you know, they would talk. They do talk. They will drive you insane speaking and saying, well, you know, when you're here, this is what I'm going to do. Or I'm going to mess with this or that or this person, or I want you to, you know, as far as Jason was concerned, it really liked to focus on that. And it would tell me, you know, just punch him, you know, go up to him and hit him. And it was never something I did, but that torment of being told that, you know, having to fight that mentally, it's just like, no. And of course, no one around you hears this. These are things you don't tell everybody, but it's almost a constant barrage of this.
Had you ever considered psychiatric help just to make sure this wasn't your way of dealing with the death, the change, guilt, the survivor's remorse, all of that?
Yeah, I actually did go in and get counseling and go into a psychiatrist. You know, did all those things. And I had on and off for years because I suffer with depression and anxiety. And so I did, especially because I had heard these things before my husband died. I didn't know what they were. And it wasn't often. It wasn't common. And after I would hear this, I would be very weak and out of it for a few days. And I just assumed that I was just stressed out beyond, you know, my ability to cope with it. And I was on different medications. They tried so many different medications over a course of, you know, several years. And I was diagnosed with a bipolar disorder. And then, no, you don't have bipolar disorder. You're, you have ADHD, and, you know, it was always something and always a different medication, and nothing would help, you know, nothing could fix things. It was very frustrating. So, you know, I did go that route quite a bit. And this was something so different. These voices, it's not, I wish there was some way to explain, you know, how it really felt. You know, it's not you. You know, there's not this, oh my gosh, am I just, this is, you know, my mind's playing. It's so obvious. It's so obvious that it is not you, that it's horrifying. You just get this numbness because you don't, I mean, how do you can't really cope with it, and you can't run from it. You can't turn it off, and you can't sleep. It's hard to eat.
Were you starting to have some dark thoughts as well, thinking to possibly end your life?
No, I never did.
That's
good. Know what? I never did. And I think that too, you know, I don't think that that's what they wanted, because, you know, this was like, it was like a perfect thing for them. And I never thought that. I never did.
Good.
I was much stronger than that. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why I was able to, you know, endure this for such an amount of time, because of that strength that I have. And as much as they broke me down, I still was not going to give up. I still had to fight, because I had these kids I had to fight for.
Right.
And I had a life I had to fight for, and I was not going to give that up.
All right,
no matter what happened.
You decide to go to war with this, and you've got the help. What kind of religious group is helping you with this, aside from the paranormal investigators, who in most cases, and I'm just being honest, I don't know which group you worked with, but in most cases, paranormal groups are not suited to deal with true demonic issues. And any of them that tells you they are is most likely blown smoke. I've watched hard and true paranormal investigators run like 3-year-old girls, you know, from a spooky clown. when something demonic actually rears its ugly head, which is few and far between, but nobody's really prepared for that. So did you have clergy, real clergy, or universal church clergy that came to your aid?
The group itself was comprised of people with different beliefs.
Good.
Okay. And you're right as far as the fact that, you know, they really, that visit, they were stunned. I mean, it was, I felt so horribly bad, which is odd that, you know, when the visit was, when my part of it was over, they investigated further after I left, but they were so, taken aback by it. And I felt so horrible. I just met these people. And this is what happened. And it, to me, there was a lot of guilt with that, but they dealt with it like professionals. They consoled me. They said, you know, we're going to help you. We're going to do what we can. And one of the ladies, Michelle, I sat on the porch with her after, you know, everything had happened. And she said, you know what? I have somebody that I want you to talk to. She said, he's a priest. And, you know, I want to see if he can help. And of course I agreed. And, but the full impact, the full effect of it hit me then. And I realized this is bad. But, it was an Orthodox priest who came in, who decided to help. And, it was a true exorcism. It wasn't, a deliverance or, you know, it was
what is the difference between a deliverance and an exorcism? To me, it just sounds like a politically correct way of saying the exact same thing.
Well, a deliverance is sort of, you know, you see these sort of televangelists or you know, big church pastors who you know, demand that the demons come out of these people and so on and so forth, and they're not really following any sort of formal and it's not a script, but any sort of formal practice, and an exorcism, and what this was called officially is a solemn exorcism, which is sort of by the book, and it's very much like what you see on a TV.
Now,
you know,
was it affecting you physically? Were you contorting? Were you changing? You know, people, again, you brought up The Exorcist earlier. People think of those things when they think of possession.
Yes. Yes, I did. I called them attacks, but I, you know, that's just what I called them. But when these things would happen and they would fully take over, yes, it was convulsing. It was vocal changes, sounds coming out of me, horrific. It was scary. It was it was painful. There were times when it was very painful, and they varied in degree and how, you know, how long they would last and how intense they were, but they were very uncomfortable. I know for me and for everybody else, you know, I say everybody else, but only a few people, witnessed it. And, it was like that. It was worse. It's not, you know, the movies are the movies, and special effects are what they are, but it really happening when this really happens, it's completely different. Everything around changes. The air in the room changes, the feeling in the room, the energy, and just takes on a whole other, a whole other life. It's bizarre. There's nothing about it that you can sort of, you know, rationalize or connect with reality.
Go ahead. No, you, please.
You can go ahead.
No, you. Don't possess my interview. You go first.
Okay. It's, I can't, you know, in the book, I've written this book, and I go into greater detail about how, you know, how it feels from my perspective. I'm not sure that anybody's ever really tried to tell people what it's like from the inside. And you take a back seat inside yourself. You literally are thrust you know, into the back. It's like someone taking over a car that you're in, and you, right. you can't do anything about it. You know, you have those dreams where you're in a car and nobody's driving, you know what I'm saying? And like you're out of control, and it's really scary. It's not what people think. I'll put it that way. It's definitely not what people think. And in the book, I really tried to go into that from the perspective of the person that is enduring it and going through it. And, you know, to try to help people see, you know, how real it is and what effects it does have on you. And if you're asking if it got violent, there were times, during, before the exorcism, when I acted in a violent manner. I never hurt anybody. I hurt myself, or it hurt me. I didn't, it, you know, there was biting, that I was very bruised when it was over and sore. There was a moment before hand where I was left alone before the exorcism while everybody spoke and talked outside. And, it wanted me to get a knife and cut my leg open and just really rip my leg open so that I could see, and so that it could see what was inside. I was sitting on the couch at that point, and it had fully taken me over. So my movements were really jerky, and there were times when I couldn't breathe. And the thing is, you can't breathe, but it's not like you're suffocating, which is, it's hard to explain, but I didn't feel like I was suffocating, but I wasn't breathing, and I knew I wasn't breathing, and it didn't matter. When they're that sort of, like ingrained inside of
right.
everything that you are, things are different. I would eat and never get full. Things like that. I would go days without eating.
God, that explains why I'm so fat. I'm possessed.
There you go.
I eat and I never get full. It's a demon. Honey, did you hear that? It's a demon. I can keep eating. It's going to take it to hell with him.
No, the great thing is I lost weight, which is not great. I'm
Son
kidding, but
right.
I did lose weight, and I would eat and like it would not be enough. It was just, it really did change everything. I can't think of any part of me in my life that it didn't alter. It's not like what people think. There's a really big stigma attached to this that's, for in my case and for what I went through, that it's not what the reality of it is. And I hope that I can sort of change that a little bit, make people look at it differently, and maybe discuss it more in depth and differently. I'm not happy with the way that right. things are, you know, are approached as far as, you know, demonic and exorcisms.
How long did it take for them to fully exorcise you and give you the feel that you are all clear of what was attached?
You know what? I'm not sure. I don't know.
Was it one night? Was it two nights?
No,
was it over
it was
a month?
During, you know what? It was during the day. They picked like afternoon, like 12.
Sure,
I think 12.
Because,
you know, during
exorcism's a heavy job. You got to go out and get Perkins early bird dinner
exactly.
special afterwards. But they did it in one day, is what you're saying.
It was one day.
Okay.
It was one day.
Was it a violent?
And,
and I don't mean as in they beating you with a, you know, sepulcher or something, but I mean, was it a violent occurrence? Do you have much
yes.
memory of that?
I do have memory of it. I have memory of some of it, and I would like to think a good portion of it, but I don't think so, because people remember things I don't. And yes, I do. I have memories of, you know, of lashing out, of trying to lash out, of being held down, of, you know, there being a point where the only thing touching the floor was like the tips of my toes and the top of my head. And that was it. I know my eyes turned, you know, they glossed over like they were white at one point. I heard someone say at one point that my eyes were black. There were a few people there, you know, there was, when I woke up, it was really weird because, and I say wake up when I came to, when everything was over, there were all these people standing around and I'm like, what is this? You know, I don't know half of you, but you know, thank you. And, but there were things that happened and I tried to lash out and was angry. I know I was very tired. Really, really, you know, at the very beginning, I was exhausted physically and it's like, I can't do this. And I didn't do this. Like it kept going. And there were these lulls and moments where I would kind of come to and be like, I'm here and I'm okay. And then, you know, the priest would give me, try to give me, communion and I would agree to take it. And then, you know, just things would go crazy. And I was on the floor. I was in a chair. I remember, you know, being lifted up and put back in the chair. It was bad. It wasn't good. I mean, that goes without saying, but it was really, really difficult to go through. I don't like you don't ever want to be present. People want to be, you don't want to be present for it. You don't want to go through it. You don't, you don't, everybody all want to see a real, no, you don't. You don't want to see a real one. You don't, because it's going to change you forever. It's going to change you. And I don't think that most people are ready for that. I'll just say that, because some people walked in there to do this and they didn't know that it would change them. And you also have to think about the fact that, you know, what if this thing decides to jump out and jump into you? Because it's a very real possibility. And are you ready? Are you ready to take on that sort of responsibility? And I don't think that most people are, even seasoned investigators,
right,
like you said, especially some who aren't ready for this. I wasn't ready for this. And it is not something that you want to go through.
Exactly.
You don't. And I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Well, now you've lived through both sides of this. Is there a silver lining? Is there a happy place and an end of a rainbow for you now? Are you getting your life back together? Or is there always that kind of smoke behind you, surrounding you at times, and although not possessing you, still influencing you?
You know, there was for a long time. And I won't say much yet, but I will say that that's not the end of the story. I will say that it did not end at the end of the first exorcism, and I'll just leave it at that. But I will say that now things are changing. Things are looking up. Like the book just came out, mm-hmm. Which is unbelievable. It's something that I've aspired to do, just to write, because I've always loved to write. I've always been a creative person. But the idea that I'm a published author is really, for me, it's mind blowing. I don't know how to even express how great that is. To write the book was very tough. It was rough and it took a while.
Were you afraid that by reexamining it, looking that and opening that door up, that you might, in essence, be opening the door to its return?
And that's why it took 3 years to write. yeah, of course.
So you bored it. You bored it to death, writing 3 pages and then quitting. And so the demon's like, oh, screw this. I'm moving on to somebody who's willing to write quicker.
I don't have time for this. Right? Exactly. Didn't have time for it.
It was really hard.
I'm sorry. It sounded like you dipped way out of there. I didn't hear what the last thing was you said.
It was really hard to go through, to have to relive all these moments for pages at a time, because it takes time to write through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had to take breaks mentally and emotionally. I had to take breaks. And the book doesn't start from, you know, oh, hey, you know, we have demons. It starts from when I was a child. So it really does start at the beginning to give you sort of an overview of everything. I wanted to include that. I felt like it was important to give a good background. And so it does. There's a lot in there. It's very interesting. I've had a few people that read it so far that are just like, you know, they're really blown away by the information in it and the approach to it.
Well, we've got that link up. If you go to darknessradio.com, go to the Killer Deals link, you'll be able to find the book there. And do us a favor. If you get the books and you like the books, make sure you review the books. Give them 5 stars and tell people how much you enjoy it. That way, they continue to seek authors and bring in more of the content that we love to talk about here on the show. So please, please check that out for yourself. Before we say goodbye, Cindy, is there something that even after you wrote the book, you thought, man, I wish I would have included this? Here's one nugget. Here's one thing that really, you know, I should have brought into this. One secret left to unfurl.
Well, there's not anything that I look back and think, okay, well, this was integral to the whole story, and I really should have put this in. I was very careful about that and wanted to make sure that I did this the right way. Like I said, there is more to the story, after the book ends. And when you read the book, you will be able to kind of pick up on it. But I will say that, I am working on, you know, batting around the idea of letting everyone know exactly what else happened. So you need to just stay tuned for that.
Oh, and, come on. Give us one little nugget so we know what to look for in the future.
Well,
nobody's listening. It's just you and me. We're buddies here. Just one little nugget left.
The book is called The Exorcism of Cindy Sauer.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first one. How about that?
Oh, interesting. So the story continues.
The story does continue.
The Exorcist of Cindy Sauer, Part 2, The Heretic. I think that's what the original Exorcism sequel was called. Thank you so much, Cindy. Have a great weekend, and happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me on.
And happy Mother's Day to all of our listeners out there that are in the role of mother, whether it's a teacher, a mentor, a godmother, an aunt, whatever it is, thank you, and step up, continue to educate, and give your children in your lives the information that they desire. Help them learn. Encourage them to listen to shows like this that can expand their minds and horizons. We'll be back again with you. Remember, next weekend, we're off this week. We'll be back next weekend as we begin our foray into Saturday and Sunday programming. Monday through Friday, you can catch me on Midnight in the Desert live from 11 p.m. Central to 2 a.m. Or you can subscribe over at midnightinthedesert.com and never miss another minute of all the talk radio. You're going to get 5 days a week there. You'll get 2 days a week here. Plus, we're back with our True Crime Tuesday program. So check it out for yourself, midnightinthedesert.com, darknessradio.com. And we will be back next weekend on the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Beyond the Darkness.
Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com. You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in 3 delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with concentrates. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.